The Reaction podcast. I'm Alistair Benn, deputy editor. I'm joined by Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. Apologies for the long hiatus, listeners. We've been confronted with a series of technical problems. You know, one person's Wi-Fi is working one week, the others aren't, and vice versa. But finally, I think we've sorted it. This week, we're going to focus on three questions. Has Keir Starmer blown it? Will we, or how do we get our liberties back? And what is filmmaker Adam Curtis on about? Ian, can you kick us off with Keir Starmer? What did you think about his speech? What did he do well? What did he do badly?
Yeah. It's very interesting when you get these moments in the political cycle when it's decided that someone is struggling and a consensus emerges, which is, I think, is often baffling to readers or to voters in general. Why is it that there's just sort of Fleet Street has decided, apparently all as one, spontaneously, that Keir Starmer's got a problem and that he isn't cutting through in the way that you might expect? He's Boris has had an appalling year in many respects because of COVID. And Labour's not opened up an opinion poll leading. How can this be? This must mean that Keir Starmer is in a lot of trouble. I'm very sceptical of that analysis, not because I think he's doing brilliantly, but we can discuss what he's doing right and what he's doing wrong. But I think if you look at where he started and where Labour was before he became leader of the Labour Party after the disastrous performance in the last election, Labour was in ruins, really, with the anti-Semitism problem, had attempted to get Jeremy Corbyn elected as leader. So I think the fact that Starmer has managed to get Labour back almost neck and neck, Tories sometimes have, the Tories have a small lead, and Boris is probably, thanks to the vaccine business, is ahead in terms of personal ratings, though the pandemic is a weird time. I think it's far too early to write Starmer off. I'm going to write more about this for the site at some point. And I think it's probably 3 to 4 years until the next UK general election. And in that time, a hell of a lot can happen to the economy. The Tory party's been in power for a long time. And that's not to minimise any of the challenges facing Starmer, but I just don't buy the convenience of my trade, political journalist, deciding en masse that the story needs to change, which the story was Boris is in trouble late last year, now becomes Starmer is in trouble. I think it's much more interesting and complex than that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been said so much, I guess it's almost a cliche of the debate over Starmer. It's, you know, he's run the right to a hearing from the British public. You know, they don't instantly hate him, you know, and that's his main quality so far. And I think Stephen Pollard put it very well, who's editor of the Jewish Chronicle, put it very well on Twitter. You know, a lot of the criticism of Starmer, you know, it's fine as far as it goes, but, you know, you've got to really strip it of context, you know. The normal rules of politics simply do not apply in an emergency. Polling doesn't necessarily reflect the kind of shifting moods of the public. You know, the guy has none of the traditional political kind of pinch point moments to get momentum off, you know, because, you know, the budgets or the statements so far have been mostly about the Chancellor doling out more money and about strengthening support packages for the economy and socialising business. I mean, what very little you can maximise out of that kind of thing. Personally, I would have liked Labour and the Liberal Party to have been a voice for, attempted to articulate a kind of social justice view on the pandemic and on the kind of the burdens that have been, you know, borne particularly by the most vulnerable in our society, that they have chosen really not to do that and to kind of basically follow on from what the government is doing is not, I think, you know, it's patently quite cynical, but also good politics. I mean, there's very little to be gained by marking yourself out as someone who's going to speak up for, you know, those groups or that agenda at the moment. But that's my own.
Yeah, break. I mean, I think in organisational terms, it's worth remembering. Okay, it's different for a prime minister. A prime minister has access to the bully pulpit, in power, spending lots of money, and can communicate directly from the podium in number 10. If you're leader of the opposition, which is, as many occupants of that office can testify, it is one of the worst jobs going. Nobody forces the occupant of that office to do it, but still, it's a very, very difficult job to do. And he's doing it without recourse to all of the stuff that an opposition leader would usually be able to do, would usually be able to charge around the country, making speeches. Did make a speech today, but in this kind of weird online world, it doesn't really count. But when you're charging around the country, you can energize people, you can hold rallies, you can actually meet with your team properly with your shadow cabinet and create some sense of energy and momentum. Though that's an unfortunate word in connection with the Labour Party. So he hasn't been able to do that. And he's stuck in this weird sort of Zoom bubble and having to isolate. The choice that he's made, I mean, I wonder what would have happened, Alistair. It is a really interesting the counterfactual. I suppose the Labour Party's position was so fragile after Corbyn, and Starmer's first responsibility, he would have seen it, as well as I'm sure he thinks lockdown, etc., is the right policy, was to establish the Labour Party's patriotic credentials. I mean, I think it becomes more and more apparent when you look at what happened in the last election, that this sense that Labour's patriotism was in doubt, not just because of Brexit, but because of Corbyn's record, that's really what did for Labour in the red wall. So it would have taken an act of exceptional political bravery in the middle of the pandemic for Starmer, and also very difficult, you know, it's easy now with hindsight, but he'd have had to say early on in the pandemic, do you know, I'm going to take a different approach here. I'm not going to go with the politics of national emergency and rowing in behind the government's broad position. I'm instead going to set out something different, which is rooted in the idea of liberties and, as you said, social justice. Because it has been, as you've pointed out, throughout the crisis, it's the solutions employed by the political class, and I'm sure we'll come on to this in a second, the question of when do we get our liberties back, have been primarily middle-class solutions. We've mentioned it several times on this podcast, the notion of this being a crisis in which the middle class in nice, comfortable houses, not all, but a sort of broad middle, are then brought their online shopping by the new working class. That is lockdown. And at the bottom end of the social scale, I can't even begin to conceive of what it's like, a family of five or six halfway up a tower block in an area which has, you know, been promised leveling up, and the kids are not at school, and obvious impacts and stresses and strains. But so he's not sided with that. But I can't quite see how he could have done. I mean, the other thing is that he attempted to do that this week on the economy. I'm not some kind of Starmer fan. I'm interested in him and interested in what he's trying to achieve, and in a two-party system, which is what English politics broadly is. Scottish politics is a different kind of political party system. Then it is healthy for there to be proper competition. So the Labour Party needs to get its act together. So I'm fascinated by it. I have some major concerns about him. The loyally aspect, there's something too stiff and formal about him, which weirdly might actually play in Scotland as well as the name Keir. So I'm not necessarily convinced by him, but on the economic stuff, that's really surprised me. And it's quite daring that he has tried to reposition himself in the last 10 days, or Labour has, as being the party that's not going to put your taxes up. That's a massive shift. Now, there's a different question about whether you believe it. My instincts about Starmer would be that Starmer, if he became Prime Minister, would be one of the most left-wing occupants of that office. You look where his politics comes from. I also don't necessarily, you know, like the positions that he took on something like the Leveson business and freedom of the press and all of that. But still, I think you've got to. I just think it's too easy, this convenient narrative that the Westminster press has fixed on in the last few weeks. He's in trouble. Let's sort of poke him and build up this idea of a leadership crisis. I just think is wildly overblown.
Yes, and also sort of soft left elements. Tom Kibasi, writing for The Guardian, for example. I don't know if I've said his name right, but kind of saying, well, you know, there's that element still where they say, well, you know, you need to, where's the language of transformation or all that jazz? And you're just sort of like, well, tried that. Didn't work. You know?
Yeah.
It was really had a good, Labour had a really good go at that one. And it doesn't seem to fit the modern reality, unfortunately, however nice it sounds. So shall we move on? Yeah, we just touched on it there, the idea of what's happened to liberties. You know, I mean, a question like, are we going to get them back, is an interesting one, because in a sense, it is in our gift when we get these things back. When the public demands, you know, in the end, the polling has to shift, right, for there to be a meaningful movement in completely the opposite direction to where we're going. At the moment, the public is in the position where they, I think, are emotionally consigned to this idea that once the vaccine rollout takes place, then things will open up again. And that may well be true, obviously, for things like hospitality and for feeling safe in pubs. Now, maybe I'm wrong about this, and it's maybe an unfair quibble, but I am sort of very depressed with the way journalists are covering this at the moment. For example, the issue of vaccine passports, the idea of lateral flow testing to be allowed to gather, was greeted by some journalists as a sort of, well, I'd do anything to have a pint. Why not?
Yeah.
Robert Peston tweeted, is such a, it's sort of arguing the toss, you know, it is such a small infringement on our liberties, such a big deal when, you know, we could feel freer in other ways. And you know, there are several reasons why I think that is a naive thing to say. One, picture the scene. It's, you know, a detention centre like Yarl's Wood or one of these places where the Home Office keeps people, undocumented people, whatever. There's a protest. Plod rocks up. Where's your vaccine pass? Where's your lateral flow test? You don't have proof? That'll be a 10 grand fine. People apply to have it. That's an unsafe process. I mean, it has happened. I mean, the nutter, you know, anti-vaxxers have had lots of big protests, which unfortunately are just, you know, full of, obviously very full of conspiracy theorists, but you know, these people were treated pretty brutally for holding a protest. That was not, as far as I could see, an acceptable thing to do. But the point is that it's not about whether we can do things safely again. That's just a bogus expression of what the argument is. It's about whether we can do things as we once did them. We don't need permission to do things, you know. And that doesn't, you know, the idea that your the freedom to gather with other people was conditional on a kind of bio passport or a bio stamp or whatever, it is a significant change in how we view disease, how we view interactions, all that's, and how we view public health and the role of the state. Those things will only be rejected and will only not happen if there is a big public outcry against them and people realise that they come with significant costs, and that argument is reflected in Parliament. Otherwise, they are just going to happen, unfortunately. You know, if polling persists and people keep on believing that these things are justified just because they make them feel safer, they will continue to happen, unfortunately. And, you know, what's fascinating to me is we've already pivoted from the vaccines being in a kind of folklorical way as the science that releases us from the political pressures we live under. This is actually a kind of illusion. Science doesn't liberate you. It merely changes the terms on which you find your freedom and find the way you want to live. It helps you live your life. For example, if you got polio in 1950 or whatever, and you were crippled for life, that would have been a serious impairment on your quality of life. It didn't. Getting the polio vaccine didn't help you lead a good life or lead a freer life in many ways. It just, you know, gave you time to do those things. And that's how we should view vaccines, I think, is that they give us time to reflect and to time and space as a society to heal. But unfortunately, I think there are very many people who are not interested in that debate and basically are naive, I think, about the authoritarianism that clearly is a feature of our life now. And I'm rambling slightly, but that is the question. Do we want to live like this or not? Vaccines settle the question for me in terms of not living like this, because vulnerable people will be protected. Elderly relatives will be protected from dying in this horrible, you know, alone in this horrible way. You know, people who have severe immunocompromised problems will be protected from dying of COVID. These are all excellent things. Those are not arguments in a way that people accept for restoring political freedoms. It's really about safety. But I think they, you know, it's just gives us the chance to live in a freer way. But again, but the British public may not agree, and that may be how we live.
But I wouldn't worry about that on one level in terms of what the public thinks. Yeah, it has been, it's been a real eye opener, and some people say, well, they always knew this, and that there was an authoritarian streak there, and that people, the overwhelming majority of people, like being told what to do, and that it's not a surprise that the sort of soft authoritarianism has landed well with the public. Also, you know, people see the disaster that's unfolded and the government getting it wrong in the early phase, and just the scale of the death and the disaster that's unfolded, and they're genuinely worried and in kind of common sense, practical way think, well, okay, you might be a lockdown, the lockdown skeptics are very aggressive about it, but if it does turn out that it killed 120,000 people or 100,000 or 140,000 people, what could it have got to? Would it have been 200, 250,000 people? And the scale of it and what that would have done to the NHS, obviously unthinkable. If you're a lockdown skeptic, or you're an enthusiast for lockdown, a sort of, you know, libertarian for lockdown, one of the strangest developments of the crisis, or most interesting developments, has been the way that people who previously would have been thought of as libertarians have, through an interest in the tech and the science, and a distaste for the wilder elements of the lockdown skeptic movement, have become really quite aggressive and draconian about this. I think a lot of us are actually in the middle. I was fascinated by what some of the scientists who were skeptical of lockdown were saying. And I like the fact that, you know, I like the fact that Boris Johnson does it reluctantly rather than joyfully. I think that's a positive. You're not dealing with a prime minister who is doing it with any relish. That's a positive thing. On the public, I don't think it will be led by the polling, Alistair. I think this is I'm quite upbeat about this. I think Parliament here can, once normal life reasserts itself, and Parliament should be back as soon as possible. I would, as we said in the reaction leader last week, I would vaccinate a lot of them, MPs, peers, everyone who works in the Palace of Westminster, and get them back and get our democracy functioning properly. I mean, which is pretty much what they did with Congress, with very little opposition, I should add. So I would do that straight away. I think it's the public outcry is not going to lead it. I think it will come from a campaign, probably within Parliament, to repeal most of the or all of the COVID laws. Because what governments do at a time like this, it happened after 9/11, after 9/11 Iraq War, the appalling terror attacks of 2005. Governments are acting in an emergency, need to do stuff, and it's just the way that bureaucracies work and machines work, that they accumulate power, a lot of it done through statutory instrument and orders in council under the guise of emergency, justifiable, but along the way extra powers are accrued, which just live on the statute book or become the norm. And as various MPs have pointed out, stuff that Tony Blair put on in an emergency still there, cluttering things up. 20 years later. So what I suspect will happen is that there will be demands in Parliament for a reset, if you like. This is what should happen, and then the government will have to come back to Parliament with proposals. And maybe I'm being too optimistic here, and argue the case on the floor of the House of Commons and in the Lords on why it needs specific powers for what will presumably be quite a tough autumn and winter, potentially, as we're all on guard for what's the next phase of this disaster. So I think part the re-energizing moment of Parliament coming back and starting to engage with these things. You see, it's all presented at the moment through the lens of the COVID recovery group and rebel Tory MPs and people demanding the end of lockdown. I think most people accept, other than really hardened lockdown skeptics, that actually something went spectacularly wrong with the new variant in a way which actually very few people predicted. Some people will point to the graph that that Whitty and Valance did, but lots of people were skeptical of that. Then something goes spectacularly wrong in December and January. We have a really, really bad second burst of this. And although people are depressed by this phase of the lockdown, people are broadly, I think, accepting roughly where we are. I think schools should be back and probably should have been back slightly earlier. But once we come through that, then the argument becomes a really fascinating argument about fundamental liberties. And just as you put it very well, we're not licensed by the state over hundreds of years in an imperfect, and I'm not making a British exceptional point because other states have had similar experiences, but over the course of hundreds of years, we've established some of those rights that you mentioned connected to how democracy functions, right to assembly, political association, not having to show your papers on demand, a particularly British obsession. And in the space of a year, through this weird globalized pandemic and techno science, it's really only because of the web that government was able to do what it was able to do, and that we're recording this podcast remotely and we're all living in our pods, and it's had this sort of weird kind of sci-fi effect. and hundreds of years of assumptions about liberty and about the role of the state have been swept away. There'll be people listening to this, and I can think of some people on the left and right who I know who will say, well, that's nonsense, and that actually, what did you expect? There's just always been that authoritarian, that the center of British politics is more authoritarian and a lot less liberal than a lot of journalists and politicians think. That was kind of Blair and John Reid's view back in the 2000s, which is electorally sensible, but I'm not sure it's the kind of country I want to live in.
Yeah. Well, it's always in... I agree with that account only in, as you say, on the authoritarian street, only if you think about it really in relative terms, which is how it matters. You know, I think there is plenty in British politics of authoritarian sort of thinking and all that stuff. But, you know, if you think compared to places which have even thinking of a society like France and the way its democracy is set up, you know, authority has a, you know, authority just has a different set of resonances. And that pervades whole social life, you know, it pervades the way the French see their school system, pervades their debate over headscarves. I mean, in this country, you just would not. I mean, there has been a debate. There is no way, I think, the kinds of restrictions on clothing would happen here, quite frankly. So in relative terms, I think Britain has a very distinctive approach to liberty, which is quite radical. It suits the kind of atomized society that we've always lived in. We have a massive city, which is one of the great global cities. You know, it suits the way we've lived for a long time. But this crisis certainly, you know, there is that stronger view, I guess, where you say, well, there was, you know, what Jonathan Sumption calls the empire of law, you know, that it was this phenomenon for a long time that people were starting to use legal solutions to political problems. And I think that's true and compelling. You see it at all levels of society, actually. You see it, people are so worried of being sued for taking risks. Mm-hmm. And that is a professional problem, and it's a problem for the state as well. Been a problem with sort of the way councils are set up for a long time. And it's true, the most hilarious and extreme example of that phenomenon is that investment banker tried to sue a ski resort in the Tyrol. Or maybe he went on a holiday there saying he knew the pandemic was happening but wasn't really aware of it, and then got COVID and seemed to be frustrated about it. Anyway, there's a piece in the Telegraph which he authored about it.
I mean, I think the thing which has surprised me and maybe even depressed me most in this phase of the crisis, other than just, oh, for God's sake, can we please all get out? And it's not even a question of going to a pub. I'd love to go to a pub, but much more interested in when can I get in a car and when can we go to Scotland and see parents and, you know, just sit in the kitchen of your in-laws and have a cup of tea. That's of much more interest than... fine, great, want to go for dinner, but it's that stuff. It's almost as though the politicians have lost sight of what this is really about, and the scale of the disruption. It's amazing how people just, the old boiling a frog thing, just what you then become used to, the idea of being prohibited from sitting with your parents having a cup of tea or a drink for 6 months would have seemed unthinkable this time last year. But the thing I'm most surprised by is the way there hasn't been a sufficient uprising. There just hasn't been an expression of our obligation and duty to the young. What I thought would happen was that you'd initially, of course, the priority, and you look at the death rates and the huge numbers of people in the over the age of 80 who've died in the last 6 weeks or so in the second burst of it. Of course, that's the primary concern. But I thought you'd get this understanding that the younger generation have made sacrifice mostly willingly and with very little backlash, understanding that it is a compact between the generations. So generations which are at no risk at all of serious illness, or only in the very rarest of circumstances and hardly any risk of death, have had life suspended for a year. So I just thought that the thing that started to burst through with people like Robert Halfon running the Education Committee at Westminster, trying to get this going, schools must go back. We do have an obligation to Britain below the age of 30 or 25, and a recognition that they have made a sacrifice, and can we please now start to let them live again? Instead, the conversation seems to be more, well, they're not going to be vaccinated, or if they are going to be vaccinated, it'll be sort of, it maybe happen in July, August. There is even a national kind of conversation about vaccine passports allowing older people to get out of the country, to sort of hop around Europe experimenting with new COVID variants, and then not letting the youngsters out. I just thought they would. Are you surprised by it, or am I being naive?
Yeah, I think it's actually not. I mean, we've talked about this a lot. It's the fundamental thing is unfortunately, is the sort of middle-aged sort of officialdom that really, I think it's the assumptions that underlie a particular comfortability in life, who are, let's be honest, are more at risk of death than people who are young, but are still not, you know, among many risks, it's not, I think it's not, you know, the dread and fear factor is probably overblown. But their assumptions have really underscored much of the debate. And at times it has felt a little bit like, unfortunately, is that the kind of boomer generation have really had their chips and are tucking in, you know, and are keeping on tucking in to the point where you're just like, well, you know, it's all very well on the sort of on a theoretical level to be like, well, in 2 years' time, the property market will crash and cities will be more fun for young people. But it's like, you know, not having access to sort of not being able to see friends, not enjoying some of the most, let's be honest, most formative and rich years of your life. And also, yeah, the debate really is about blame most of the time. Almost always you feel that, you know, people my age are seen as sort of super infection spreaders and are, you know,
vectors.
Vectors, yeah.
You see threads on Twitter where people are talking about other people, meaning young people, who I thought is it's not just a Western assumption. It's a common human assumption that older people have an obligation, a sort of duty of care to the young. But it just seems to be a minor strand of the crisis and inconvenience. You can't have these vectors out sort of running around infecting each other, even though, as we heard in the evidence in the Commons this week, there's very little evidence of schools being a major source of transmission. But, I mean, fine, we didn't know in the early stages of the crisis, and you can understand why the overreaction, but we do know now.
I mean, just to round off, I guess, is like, you know, I'm, so again, a lot of this stuff is quite personal, and you see a lot of biases come to, you know, emergency epidemics, the kind of psychology of it, the dread, you know, you can see people are affected psychologically by their own position, by their, you know, own sense of personal risk, all that. You know, personally, I've actually, you know, I'm in such a privileged position because, although, you know, I'm simultaneously very, very, you know, not at risk, let's be honest, in terms of my health profile, like, I'm not really at risk of serious illness from other stuff as well, you know, touch wood. Mm. But, you know, and I'm able to, you know, we're journalists, we can arrange our lives so that our work is basically carries on as usual. There's all kinds of reasons why, you know, I can see why people react, well, what have you got to complain about? And you saw that this week. I'm really vocalizing what's happened over a couple of instances. The KPMG chap had a go over Zoom, saying, "Well, you know, everyone's paraphrasing, sort of everyone's, you know, people need to stop moaning." And then there's a chap at the Barbican who told his employees, you know, again, "You've got jobs. Stop going on about the mental health crisis." And I kind of couldn't fail to see the connection. These two guys who are super comfortable, you know, clearly had very successful careers, are just telling young people who are literally have had everything that was valuable in their lives put on hold, you know, all sense of dynamism subdues, have probably seen their friends. I don't know anyone who hasn't really struggled in the last year. People who are in general very happy and, you know, excitable people, and people who are keen on the world, you know, they've really struggled. So I think, you know, I think we are due a bit of slack, actually. And but I really feel for the children, actually. What I'm saying really is, you know, it is children fundamentally who are paying a huge price in terms of sociability and formative experiences. And, you know, and travel is one of those things which, you know, for Engelsberg Ideas, which is a site we work on, we had a journalist, Jenny McCartney, writing about travel. Look it up. It's a fantastic piece, and about going on a French exchange and having a formative moment of being awkward with a family. And it really resonated with me because my teenage years were so many moments like that, which were awkward, where you didn't know where to be. You were neither an adult nor a child. You know, you're having to negotiate. You might feel embarrassed and look back on it with embarrassment. But actually, if you don't go through those things, you know, your life is impoverished in quite a fundamental way. And I think, you know, the rhetoric on travel over the next few years is kind of hopefully going to shift back to more like how can we actually allow people to live their lives rather than let's browbeat everyone who wants to, you know, take time away.
Yeah.
Or try and discover things, or you know, and we need to value risk takers again. You know, I was having a great conversation today with Mike Hulme, who's a geography professor at Cambridge. He said something really great, put it really well to me. He said, you know, societies which are flourishing have a nice mix of people who are risk takers and people who are maybe take less risk. You don't want everyone to be a risk taker because, you know, that would be not very stable, but you need some people who have an appetite for experience and risk and dynamism and all that, and that's really important to nourish. And I feel that, you know, we're kind of you know, safety is great, but we need to also value that as it for its own sake.
I did think though that it was interesting you mentioned that the accountancy boss who got into so much trouble in the last week, because I think the context was that he was on a call with loads and loads of employees and was, you know, telling people to stop moaning. And he said something about unconscious bias training and all the rest of it. So standard sort of modern Twitter row ensues and off you go. And the guy then has to step down. It did make me realize, because I was just flicking through again, as always doing, you know, in moments of crisis to try and remind myself that, you know, even though the lockdown's bad, it's nothing like as bad as the Second World War. And always, you know, a couple of times a year, I end up being drawn back to Alan Brooke. And I was thinking about the style of communication and how actually the need for the modern corporate boss to show empathy and to be on that Zoom call, chatting to the staff in a way, and how they dealt with it in the Second World War is you just didn't do that. So Alan Brooke's communication, or the communication of a senior civil servant or any general worth their salt, would be that stand in front of the men and speak and try and be encouraging. And men then maybe go around afterwards and speak to a few officers and a few men, saying you're doing a terrific job and stick with it, and ask some questions to try and gather intelligence about what was really going on and what morale was really like. And that was it. there wasn't an expectation in a crisis that you somehow had to emote and show your feelings and have a sort of group therapy session. But the modern corporation conceives of itself in a way that, I mean, that's really what he came the cropper with. He strayed into territory which is contested politically, because there will have been people on that call who said, well, absolutely right, unconscious bias training is a load of rubbish. And there'll be people who said, well, no, I actually got something out of it. Why is he going into territory which is not really the role of a chairman or a CEO? So it revealed something to me about modern leadership and less being more.
And finally, the section of the podcast you've obviously all been waiting for. It's our discussion of Adam Curtis. What's he on about? Is everyone enjoying the new documentary? Why is it so long? I was tasked with reviewing it for Reaction, but I pathetically only watched about two episodes because it's just pretty hard to get through it. 7 hours of extraordinary sort of, you know, occasionally feels like being beaten around the head, sort of imagery. And anyway, for anyone who is listening who doesn't know who Adam Curtis is, he's a sort of documentary filmmaker who makes these sort of big idea style documentaries, famously Bitter Lake about Afghanistan and the kind of crisis of westernization in Afghanistan, which actually is a cracking watch. But I'm sure if I was an Afghan, I would not say it was a cracking watch. I'd say it was overly crude and were basically far too full of stupid logical fallacies and didn't reflect the rich history of my country, you know. So I feel a little bit like his documentary now is about, there's a lot of it about the UK and British politics and the kind of crisis of British nationalism post-empire and the kind of the return of people who had been colonial subjects to the motherland and the kind of social problems that created. You know, this was a real, you know, but you're watching it and you kind of think, you know, that's a fascinating way of putting it, or that's a compelling kind of, this character he's talking about is fascinating, but occasionally you just think, is that, you know, does that really reflect the kind of real complexities going on here? Is that not a bit crude? But then, and again, I would say, it is actually, you know, it reminds me actually of a book called The Politics of Hysteria, which is a sort of monograph by, can't remember the writers, but is exactly that kind of big picture geopolitical history about sort of the end of empire and all that. And at times you're like, this is infuriating, this is taking this way too far. But then it's interesting, it's about ideas, it's taking on big subjects. That's not such a bad thing, because writers actually nowadays are not so much interested in that. There are very rare examples. You know, John Gray is one who tries to do kind of popular ideas and takes a strong line on stuff. You know, a lot of nonfiction nowadays is very empirical. It's like big histories. You know, like Max Hastings sort of on Vietnam, you know, 700 pages.
Yep.
The status of like, I don't know, maybe you do see it, but you know, really well-argued monographs, you know, that is actually really fun to read. And I think that's how you should take his documentaries. What are your thoughts?
Well, apologies if you haven't actually seen any Adam Curtis at all. I mean, I find his stuff infuriating and fascinating, and I'm always torn by it because it is, on one level, it's really beguiling and amusing and interesting. The footage is just his gift for finding, or whoever works with him for finding, unusual footage and the quirkiness of it. And I always learn stuff. So within a given hour or an hour and 20 minutes, and as you said, this one goes on for about 7 hours, which we'll come back to in a second, which is too long. You'll get to a 5-minute chunk where you think, wow, that's really, really interesting. I mean, there's a way in which he tells the story in the first episode of the divorce of Robin Douglas Hume and Sandra Paul, the model who became Sandra Howard, married to Michael Howard. And it's presented as a story representing the rise of individualism and her refusing to settle in a mid-60s way, refusing to settle for married convention and boldly deciding, no, she was going to be her own person and breaking with society's assumptions. And he obviously, you know, couldn't cope with that. That was a fantastic sort of 7 or 8 minute section. But equally, in the first minute, there were three highly questionable, bold political statements about what we all thought or what everyone was doing at a particular time. You say, what? Hold on. How on earth is this established? But because the soundtrack, and of course, you then go straight off to Spotify to find out which tracks are on the soundtrack, and someone's built a playlist on Spotify from the series. So his understanding of what grabs people, he's like a very good ad man with a feel for matching weird footage with really good bits of soundtrack, and then his voice is so hypnotic that you have to, it's a conscious act of will to say, hold on, let's interrogate these ideas. Is that really true? Can you really claim that? Can you really make that link? Now, he said that he really likes the fact it's now on iPlayer and it can just roll as long as he likes, which to me is maybe the fatal flaw in this one, which it seems so obvious that it needed, whether it's Alan Yentob or one of those kind of classic BBC figures, to view the rough cut at 7 hours, to take Adam Curtis for a very, very nice lunch and say, it's terrific. We absolutely love it. It's wow. It's your best thing yet. And then say, but would it benefit maybe from being half the length? And shouldn't another editor, just go over this with a fine tooth comb and strengthen some of the arguments? Because you still, it just doesn't, those tests of what we always battle with in journalism all the time, and we talk about it a lot, Alistair, is, you know, what's the headline? What's the stand first? What's the argument here, which is going to then be fleshed out? So it feels as though it's that process, I'm sure Curtis would deny that, hasn't been properly applied, and he can just sort of riff in the way that he wants. The other problem with it is that it's written so, like I mentioned this to you, it's sort of as though you gave a columnist or a blogger or a very good blogger or a columnist just a license to make endless films. And I feel like I'm kind of trapped in the Curtis world now. Every time I try and write a column and you try and do a columnly style intro, you know, I just hear Curtis's voice and a soundtrack, I don't know, like Pet Shop Boys or something playing in the background and footage of ballroom dancing in the 1950s or something. So it's, so I feel like I'm kind of trapped in Curtis's world, but what he does is very clever.
He reminds me actually of, I mean, everything comes back to the counterculture to a point where you're just like, oh, not again, like some Patti Smith doing a weird dance, and it's just like, oh, is this really? But it's a bit like Michelle. He's a bit like Michelle Welbeck, but without the sex scenes. It's, you know, it's that view of individualism and the way it develops, which is quite Welbeckian. What I do really like about Curtis, in a more serious way, is just like he does take the decline, the sort of decline of communism, seriously as like a world historical thing and as a crisis that we're kind of all sharing and living through in the West as well, and in a way that John Gray often talks about, you know,
yeah,
1989 was a crisis of Enlightenment thinking as much as, you know, the crisis of communism was a crisis of modernization, which Bitter Lake, is the documentary about Afghanistan, is very interesting about. Why I say if I was an Afghan I probably wouldn't like it, it's because Bitter Lake is really about the crisis of the West and of a crisis of modernization. Afghanistan, for Curtis, is a kind of blank slate for his own ideas. So he kind of makes the documentary about the West using Afghanistan as this blank slate for modernization. How true that actually is probably up for debate, and someone who is cleverer than me and knows more about that part of the world would be able to tell me. But that's the problem, is that Curtis in a way, is like, a filmmaker I really like is Jonathan Meads, but he has his thing. Jonathan Meads has his ponderous, overtoned thing where he just, you know, the kind of, the style is the documentary. And sometimes with Meads, you kind of think, yeah, there's a lot of content, but also this is just Jonathan Meads sort of mooching. And I think Curtis is, to be fair to him, in interviews does sort of say, well, my films are supposed to be quite fun. They're supposed to be taken on their own terms as, you know, because they are gorgeous. You know, you're watching it sometimes, you're like, that's a breathtaking cut. That's a breathtaking combination of imagery and sound. And the dancing thing, whether what purpose that shows, apart from a kind of comment on maybe the when the English context, the kind of uses this sort of these ballet dancers almost, I think, to illustrate the kind of the continuities of sort of upper class English life. But beyond that, the kind of political like usefulness of that or like meaningfulness is limited. It's just people dancing, you know. You know, it's the same in Bitter Lake where he has these mass crowds dancing in different periods. And you're like, it's just doesn't really show anything, which is quite nice, you know.
Yeah. A contrast with it, and something I would really recommend, which is on Netflix, which is A Perfect Crime. It's a very different kind of documentary, which is a four-part documentary made in Germany for Netflix, which is about a period that I'm particularly interested in, even obsessed with, which is that the switch from sort of 88, 89 into the fall of the wall and the and German reunification and what happens with the Western takeover of the East. And it centers on the murder of the German industrialist, hence Perfect Crime, shot through his library window by a sniper. Who was it? Who did it? Was it the Red Army faction? Was it disgruntled Stasi officers now unemployed? Who gave the order? Who committed the murder? Four parts, a bit like a German opera, probably a bit too, your German or an Austrian opera goes on too long, but still, it's very different from the Curtis thing that it relies on. It does assemble wonderful footage, but just the narrative flow, just with, and it's not just sort of straight up and down narrative flow, but it's show not tell. It doesn't whack you over the head all the time, giving you sort of heavy-handed hints about this is what you should think about the merger of or the Western takeover of East Germany, and this is how it fits into a bigger theory of the end of communism. It just tells you an extraordinary story and allows you to think about it yourself. So if you haven't seen A Perfect Crime on Netflix, I would really recommend it. I think we're going to wrap it up there, actually, but we had meant to talk for about half an hour, and we've way overrun. And if you have been listening, thank you very much for tuning in. If you're not a Reaction subscriber and you're listening to this, go to the website and you become a subscriber. You get my weekly email. You get the Reaction Weekend email, which comes from Alistair. You get all of the great stuff which the Reaction team produce all week. And you also then get invites to our discussion show, Answer Time. Next episode of that is the 2nd of March, and we'll be sending out details to subscribers soon. But thank you very much for listening.